You have over $2.1 billion in assets. Before I say this, minus political anything, minus the political stuff, but I'm strictly looking at wealth and wealth building. I know you've crossed paths with the man who has worked with Trump on his wealth building journey.
Oh yeah, I was kind of worried where you're gonna take this one, but yeah,
Before, and that was before the political stuff.
I don't think anybody is as quick and sharp as me in certain areas and as creative, and also combine that with working hard. I have a lot of self-belief in myself in that arena. Great question. Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you so
Not
much for.
often that I don't get asked the same old boring stuff again and again and again.
Well, thanks so much for being here. You're the first person who has over a billion in assets here. So it's an honor. I'm so happy you came.
You're up, you're ready, and you're listening to the Brittany Mac podcast. Everyone has a story, applying them to inspire the world weekly on Motivation Mondays. Here's your host, Brittany Mac.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Bring and Make podcast. Today we have Mr. Lane. He's an ex-engineer, investor, family office consultant, and he owns over, is it 4,000 plus or 10,000 plus units?
10,000 unit apartment units, and then total sum of $2.1 billion the assets.
Yes. Yeah, so introduce yourself to our audience.
Yeah, so today we run a syndication company. We buy apartments, we rehab it, we fix it up, we bring in passive investors. But kind of my big why is to help out, folks kind of where I was not too long ago. I graduated college back in 2007 and kind of lived that linear path that I think a lot of us are duped into of studying hard, going to school, working for the man for 40 years, and all the while buying a house to live in, which I don't think is a great idea for most young people, and investing in the volatile 401k and traditional investments. So, I have a podcast, Passive Real Estate Investing via Simple Passive Cashflow and simplepassivecashflow.com, bestseller Amazon book. We have a new one coming up here shortly. But yeah, my mission is I never liked my engineering job. And when I found rental real estate and eventually syndications and private placements, I discovered that there was a much quicker path outside of, much quicker path to financial freedom.
Yes. And you mentioned that you have over $2.1 billion in assets. Is that total assets or just a portion of your assets?
Yeah, that's total assets. So we own maybe about 40 or 50 individual apartment buildings. And typically they'll be anywhere from 100 to, I think our biggest ones are in the 400 unit size. So, most of those assets are in the $20 to $50 million range. And we do this kind of on purpose. I think a lot of people know about buying rental real estate. Well, when you're buying assets that are under $5 to $10 million, which includes small apartments and especially the single family homes, stuff that I started with, there's a lot of competition and the pricing just doesn't work. There's just a lot better pricing within, the stratosphere of $10 to $50 million in assets. But I mean, I'll be the first one to tell folks, right? There's a lot of fake gurus out there trying to teach people how to do this stuff. You're not going to go buy a large apartment complex right off the bat. And neither did I. And I started investing in 2007. As I saved my money and bought my first property in 2009, and I was still buying little rental properties up until 2015 when I had 11 little single family homes.
Yes, you've always pretty much, even before becoming an entrepreneur, not an entrepreneur, but before doing the engineering, you've had like an entrepreneur mindset because around about 13 years old, am I right? Around 13 years old, you were already trying to see how you can invest.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, some I was also like selling, candy at school to the other rich kids. Definitely, China had that itch to make money, right? Because I guess, I grew up in a household where, whether it's right or wrong, money gives you options, money gives you power. Maybe it was just the way my parents brainwashed me to kind of do my homework and study hard to, go to college. But that was the dogma that I got brought up in. And yeah, it's helped me up to get to this point. But like that only kind of takes you so far. And people get caught up in this, I think, this idea of like workism, of working a corporate job, and part of that is going to college, and you're kind of stuck in it because you've invested so much time and money for that degree, and then you kind of get stuck, and now you're working a 9 to 5. You might be making a great salary. Most of our investors, they make $200,000, $300,000 a year at their day jobs, but they're essentially stuck on the golden hamster wheel, paying a lot of taxes. And the real reason why they're stuck is they're investing in traditional investments, such as the Wall Street products that the financial planners sell and get their commissions off of. It's kind of a rigged system in reality.
Yes. And I know instead of just trying to invest in the type of like stocks and stuff, you rather invest in cash flow because stocks and things like that is kind of a gamble, and then cash flow allows money to constantly flow in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like I don't have any stocks. I don't really believe it. I mean, it's to me, it's kind of fake assets. My big three th rules of investing is, invest in things that's real, that provides society with a hard, tangible utility. And you don't get as more basic than houses or apartments, right? People need a place to live. Secondly, the taxes, right? Like, we're able to take a huge amount of depreciation and passive losses from, this is written into the IRS tax code as a huge incentive for real estate owners, and we're able to pay a lot less taxes legally. And then, the last thing is, especially when you're starting out, right? When your net worth is under $1 million or $2 million, focus on cash flow, right? Then, the things that, businesses, or I call an apartment building a business, right? It's making money on a monthly basis. There's income and there's expenses, and there's a buffer at the end, a profit margin, that's your cash flow. And especially for me starting out, right? Like, when I was in my 20s, my biggest goal was to just quit my day job. And the way I figured how to do that is just replace my paycheck, or my monthly salary, with cash flow from these investments. And I think that's a great starting point for people to start with. Unfortunately, we're all kind of brainwashed with this idea of, save your money in these Wall Street investments that make Wall Street folks rich, and create this big pile of cash, right? Whether that's $1 million, $2 million, $3 million. And then when you're kind of old and you hit retirement, then you kind of live off of that pile of cash. I think the whole system is completely upside down, where in reality you need to be creating small cash flow streams today, whether that's buying little rental properties, or doing the syndication deal here or there, breaking up your net worth into smaller chunks. And collectively, those cash flow streams will compound on each other. Like, when I had 11 rentals back in 2015, and I was making a few hundred dollars of cash flow after all expenses and CapEx. So that was, about $3,000 a month. Not enough to quit my engineering job, but, I think people get the point, right? Like, it kind of steamrolls after a certain point, and it definitely surpasses your income. And that is, the point where this concept of being financially independent, or another analogy is being, hitting zero gravity, right? This point where your money is working harder for you than you are working for your money.
Yes. So, what are the high cash flow markets where the numbers make sense?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we do is, pretty basic, right? But it is, backed by numbers. For new investors, I talk a lot about this concept of the rent to value ratio. So we look for stuff that's hitting this 1% rent to value ratio better. You find the rent to value ratio by taking the monthly rent divided by the purchase price. So, for example, I mean, where are you located? What MSA are you located in, Brittany?
Tampa, Florida.
Yeah, Tampa, Florida is not bad. You can probably find what's a median house out there, like 250 grand or something like that.
I will have to look that up.
Yeah.
I'm not
I'm
familiar at the
guessing.
moment.
I'm guessing. I mean, and you probably rent that for maybe about $1,500, $2,000 a month. So the rent to value on that would be just a shy under 1%. So the math would be, $2,000 divided by $250,000. Other places like California, you'll be lucky to find a place in the ghetto for 500 grand that'll rent for pretty much the same price. And that's like more on the scale of 0.5%. So, that kind of answer your question. That's the first thing we look at is the numbers. Are we going to hit this rent to value ratio so that we're able to cash flow on a monthly basis? Typically, the kind of the look back in the back of the textbook for the answers, they're typically in red states, and another reason why we do that is we don't like to be in blue states where the landlord laws are against us and we're kind of climbing uphill against that. And the red states typically are a little bit more economically friendly and, more growth states. Not to say anything politically, but, we tend to invest in more emerging markets, makes a lot of sense, right? Where people are moving there and places where the numbers make sense.
Right. And to answer your question about Tampa's home value, the average Tampa home value is $379,661.
Yeah. So what I would do, just for quick and dirty, like if people want to kind of go on their Google machine, that's the average home price. I would look at the median home price instead, because you know how home values are. It's always kind of skewed by the super wealthy people, which event, you know, if you follow this program, you'll eventually be pretty wealthy. So I'm not gonna poo-poo those people because it's us. But
Yeah,
you,
that's
you
definitely
look
the
at that median
goal.
home price and you look at something just shy under that, multiply that by 80%. That's typically around that kind of level what we're looking for. We're looking for a apartment or house that, is serving that lower middle class, that working class. We don't invest in pretty luxury properties because the numbers aren't going to work. At the same point, although the numbers look better on the low end, we don't invest in rough areas. We call those kind of C class, D class, and war zone areas. There's sort of a there's always a sweet spot in the middle, right? As people understand the theory of diminishing returns. And what I find is, if you're around this B minus, B plus class of housing, which, in Tampa, that would probably be somebody in an apartment paying $1,000 to $1,500 a month. And the reason why we like that is, it's essentially recession proof. Because, when the recession comes next year, which we know it is, hopefully it's pretty mild, what happens? Well, it's the luxury people are going to be laid off. They're going to need to come down to a B plus, A minus property. The A minus people are going to come to the B plus. And there's this cascading effect to more value-oriented housing. And here we are, right? We love it because we actually get better qualified tenants coming back for us.
That makes perfect sense. So, to be clear, can you which I actually do get what you're saying. What's the difference between a class A, class B, or class C asset?
Yeah, I mean we grade them two ways. So there's a grading system with the property. Normally that runs on like the age of the property. So something built, year 2000 and later, that's going to be kind of newer class A. Your B class is going to be built like 1980s and maybe even 1970s, and then class C is like 1970s, 1950s. Just as a general rule of thumb. What's harder to quantify is the neighborhood class, which is, the A class are going to be your cool yuppie area, right? The B class is going to be, relatively safe during the daytime, but I don't know if you want to be out there at night, right? Like you kind of know those areas. The C class areas is like, you try to stay away from there even in the daytime.
Yeah, like the
I mean, I guess I would call the hood. I mean, C class can be rough, right? We've had properties in class C areas before. I would categorize Warzone and class D more like the hood, right? Like, but I mean, I know you're no dummy, right? You're not going to go cruise out there in a class C area unless you have to, right? But that's, again, that's kind of the sweet spot is like, we want to buy a property in a better area, a B or better area. And I'm okay buying a class C asset, like an older asset, because we can do something with that asset. And typically what we do is we'll change out the flooring, appliances, new paint job. Some call it putting lipstick on a pig, right? And just because our business plan is to put maybe $4,000 to $8,000 into the unit, which when we do it to all the units, we get great economies of scale. And this is really where you see a lot of house flippers out there, and to take a property and bump the rents up a couple hundred, few hundred dollars, they may have to spend 20, 40, 50 grand to do that, because it's not cookie cutter. It's all like custom jobs where you don't get any much more turn 'em and burn 'em, rinse, wash, repeat with these apartments, right? We can get great economies of scale with that. And that's how we're able to get a rehab cost so low. But generally what we're trying to do is just bump the rents incrementally, hundred, couple hundred bucks across the board.
So other than apartments and rentals, what other recession-proof asset classes are there?
Yeah, I mean, in our world of all, this is all the world of alternative investments, right? I don't know where that whole word came from. Again, it's all the Wall Street creating all these, demonic terms for alternative investments, but I don't know how much traditional you can get than good old-fashioned real estate. But other things that investors in our ecosystem will be interested in is like self-storage, mobile home parks. I'm not a huge fan of mobile home parks. They're a little bit on the lower end, just not my business strategy. I tend, when we first started, we would buy a lot of like 50 unit, 100 unit class C properties. And, as the operator, in charge of the asset, it's just a little bit too much effort for the juice. Like I said, we tend to prefer, that more that B class type of tenant and location. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's assets, like I was saying at the top, right? Like things that provide utility to the masses. And if tough times, it's not going to go away. Like shopping malls, no one is going to a shopping mall, right? Like that's a systemic change that's happening. Some say the same thing is happening with office, right? At the same time, I do tend to like, the little grocery store, strip malls that are out there. They're not shopping malls, but they're more shopping centers. I think that that is going to, that's kind of going to be around, right? Even with Amazon and, where are you going to get your haircut from? Where are you going to get your groceries from? Not everybody's going to get it delivered like Amazon, do that type of stuff. But yeah, it's, a lot of it's just very basic, right? And I think the people on Wall Street, they try and make this very hard and complicated to confuse us and make us, respect them and hand over all our money to them, where, a lot of this isn't rocket science, right? People need a, place to live, and you can kind of see where the good areas and the bad areas are. And at the end of the day, if you're investing in things that produce cash flow and provide, real utility to people, I mean, you're going to be in business, which is quite the opposite of crypto, right? Crypto is, yeah, I get it. Some people say it's a currency, but as far as I'm concerned, if there was a nuclear disaster, what the hell can that do for you, right? You can't eat it. It provides, it gets killed on the taxes side. There's no any type of appreciation or losses on it. And I mean, I guess it could cash flow, but there went FTX with all that staking stuff, right?
it's not as practical as, what real estate offers.
I mean, the bad thing about real estate is, you need money to invest in real estate. If you don't have money, real estate is a capital intensive business. You need at least a 20% down payment. Or, you need to be you have a certain net worth to get involved in this stuff. And that in lies the good part for people who are in, because it definitely thins the crowd. You don't have the masses of 16-year-old boys on the Robinhood apps competing with you. You've definitely thinned the herd, buying rental properties, or especially if you're buying apartments, alongside us. And I think that's what I really like. It's, as much as it's hard to get in, once you're in, it's a very stable asset class, and it provides utility. And at the end of the day, we really pride ourselves on, creating value, rehabbing units, improving the community. Of course, we see it in our pocketbook at the end of the project, right? When we sell it for more. But I think somebody told me a long time ago, wealth comes to those who create value. And a lot of people that are trying to do these get rich quick schemes like crypto or buying and selling things on Amazon, technically you're not creating any value there. You just buy low, sell high.
Yeah, I definitely feel like things like that you shouldn't like prioritize that, because it's kind of like a gamble and you don't know how long you can keep something like that up, even if you are, say, lucky in it at a point. So that's why real estate things and things like that is definitely becoming more and more like I'm opening my eyes more and more and more to it and appreciating that asset more.
I mean, it's not gonna get you these huge returns. And that's why I tell my folks, right, this is not a get rich quick scheme. This is a slow and steady, but it'll get you there, with a high certainty, especially if you diversify into multiple deals and assets. And at the end of the day, it's boring businesses, and real estate is one of the most basic boring businesses out there. Those are the things that the wealthy people do. It's not the people on, the kids on Clubhouse and, all these guys that are trying to, capitalize on these short-term trends. And I think that's kind of where my eyes were open, right? Like, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I learned was interacting with high net worth people and emulating what does the quiet wealthy people doing, or I call it like the stealth wealth people.
Yes, and I know before I say this, minus political anything, minus the political stuff, but I'm strictly looking at wealth and wealth building. So I know you've worked with, well, I don't know if you worked with him, but I know you've crossed paths with the man who has worked with Trump on his wealth building journey.
Oh yeah, I was kind of worried where you're gonna take this one, but yeah,
Before then, that was before the political stuff.
I mean, I'm not a huge fan of some of the antics, right? But 10, 20 years ago, if you watch what Trump did, he was it was very basic business plan. He was buying up properties in New York, and he was kind of flipping them. There was a need. There was a lot of a glut of office, and they were flip-flopping it to residential because they needed a residential. So it's basically the way I see it. It's like, what do entrepreneurs do, right? They see a problem, they see a need, and they go out there and they freaking solve it. And of course, they handsomely rewarded, right? And one would say like that move. Sure, there's required lots of money to buy those high skyscrapers and to rehab them and repurpose them, but a very basic business plan. It's not rocket science with this stuff. We obviously play it on a much more smaller level. We'll buy these garden style apartments, and we're also we also are getting into more developments because I think the profitability and security of the asset is a lot more safe. Because lately I've been, normally we'll buy apartments like in Texas is a great market that we're in. We'll buy an apartment in the Class C, Class B sector for about 120 grand a unit, where, single family homes cost, like I said, like you said, are like $200,000 to $300,000 for equivalent. But we'll buy it for $120,000 a unit, of course, within, groupings of 100 to 300 units. But on that property, it's usually 1970s vintage, so that's, you're talking like 50 years old at this point. And, if we, what we're kind of moving towards as a group is like, why don't we just build the apartment for like about a, $220,000 to $240,000, and now that asset is brand new. It's still workforce housing, right? It's not luxury. There's no bar in the clubhouse or anything like that that you see in a lot of these more downtown luxury projects, but it's still workforce housing. Average rents between 1300 to 1700 for a one bedroom or two bedroom. And it serves that purpose for the lower middle class, or should I say the shrinking middle class that is getting displaced downward. And like that's like, now I have an asset that is just a little bit more expensive, but it has an additional 50 years of runway. Where that 1970s property, sure, I can rehab it, put a little lipstick on a pig, but still the bones of it is from the 1970s. It's 50 years old.
It's so funny. I didn't know what it meant, what people meant by the bones of a property until just probably yesterday. I saw on TikTok somebody was talking about if someone says that, oh yeah, this has really good bones. Like just saying it has great bones, they would say that it's a good job and you just basically only have the bones to work with, which were the structure. So that's funny. I just learned about that and now I'm hearing about it again.
Yeah, I mean, like, with the commercial properties, once things get 1940s, 1950s, so I guess that would be about 60, 70 years old. Eventually, do you want it, you're going to demolish the dang thing. Just like look at the Las Vegas casinos and hotels, right? Like Circus will just get demolished after at some point. I consider Circus more of a C class type of asset now. Because it just gets old, right? The bones is kind of discussed as more of a structural thing. Although, they engineered these buildings to last 100 plus years. But I would say it's more from like a, functionally obsolete type of viewpoint. And, like people don't want to be living in a property that's older than 50, 70 years. They just know. And that's where, like, that's why, like a lot of our investors will ask, like, you guys will buy a 1970s, 1980s property, bump the value on it, rehab the units so they look, great. Just from the interior, you can't really tell the difference between something built in the 2010s and something, that the way we get it. But at the day, we exit the property within 5 to 10 years. Because we don't want to be holding on to that asset because it's quite frankly old. We kind of we're playing that slow flip game. Get out of it.
What are some of the best ways to raise money to be able to afford to get into this market?
Yeah, I mean that's not gonna happen, right, these days. I mean there's a gazillion people teaching people how to do this supposedly. That's the best way to raise money is to trick people into buying your $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 program.
Okay.
The truth is, I mean, like, the cards are stacked against you, right? Like, to get into this business, you need to have closed past large 10, 20, $30 million assets. So if you don't have a rental property portfolio, two, I don't know what business you have taking other people's money. That just sounds really irresponsible to me. Especially when those first people are going to be friends and family. I guess that's why they call it friends, family, and fools. What I would say, go out, buy one property and just learn. And then come back and look at, buying the big stuff. But, of course, there's all these like fake gurus out there on the internet, especially social media that are, trying to trick people into buying their expensive program. That's why I don't do any of it. That type of stuff. I just think it's unethical, right? That's been kind of real estate gurus' MO for the last 20, 30 years, right? I work with higher net worth investors. And all our education is kind of free on my podcast and website and my book. It's just not going to happen for people. I mean, you can try if you want to burn up 50 grand on education or even 20 grand on education, but I'm in the camp of, hey man, you got 20 grand, just go put that into a down payment in a $100,000 house, 20% down payment, and start from there. Because quite frankly, that's what I did. I started back in, bought the first property 2009, and then I just saved up my money and bought another one. And that's why this is a capital intensive business. Most of our investors, they make multiple six figures, or at the very least, they're able to save $50,000 to $100,000 a year. If you make less than $20,000, if you're able to save less than $20,000 a year, I would probably say you have a money problem. And I don't want to come across as pompous, but either you have to make more money. I'm not a huge fan of college or school, but that's one way you can do that. Or you may have a expense problem, right? Like you don't keep a budget. I was kind of blessed by being brought up in a pretty rigid family where we didn't spend money we didn't have. And we also were pretty cheap with our money. We didn't go to the restaurant and buy soft drinks. You got water, that's free. And out of college, I had a good paying engineering job. Probably a lot less than what the kids get paid today, but I was able to save a good 50 grand a year out of college to kind of plow into investing. And I did that from 2009 to 2016. So, it's just not, again, like not a get rich quick scheme in my opinion, but if you're looking for, to get on that escalator and you do have a good paying job, I think real estate is a great way to do it,
So save your money, and then after you get enough money to get in the game, then get in the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's not probably what most people want to hear, but
But you're being
again, I don't.
practical and
Yeah,
honest.
like there are some people out there that are really frugal with their money. They're maxing out their 401ks. I mean, that's typically a lot of our investors, and we're all like, no, don't do that, right? Because that's all traditional investments that make Wall Street rich, the Wall Street roller coaster. But those are typically the pedigree of our community is people who've maxed out their 401ks in their 20s and 30s and still scratching their head, why is our net worth still under $1.5 million? And that's where what we teach people is how do you invest passively in syndications and private placements and rentals, so you can get the passive activity losses, the tax benefits, to pay a lot less in taxes. And then we also teach people have they can Google infinite banking. We call it, we do it a little bit differently, kind of the more the new age one with accredited investor banking. But when you combo those three things, that's really all you need to know, right? There's so much financial noise out there. But again, we kind of cater towards the guys between $1 to $10 million net worth and getting to that point.
Yeah, it is a lot of financial noise, 'cause at first I was looking at what is it? Airbnb. I was looking at Airbnb one way, but after seeing a lot of these Airbnb stories, I'm kind of looking at it a little different.
Yeah, I mean, but let's break it down, right? Like the business plan, it's that is a very discretionary line item on people's spending, right? Like when times are good, it's really good. And that's what it was the last several years. But again, look at stuff from a viewpoint of like what happens when shit goes wrong, right? When there's a recession. Like I said, like that's where workforce housing comes into play. And actually the demand sort of improves. And there might be some displacement of people in the short term, but now people are looking more for value type of housing. And they sure ain't going to go on vacation and live in your guest house, right?
And sometimes people might, like, if you do the Airbnb, you might see that your guests don't want to leave and you have to evict them. So I feel
Oh
like
geez, yeah. You would think that wouldn't happen, right? Because your clientele is a little bit, higher end. But Yeah, you know, like a lot of this is, you know, operational businesses, right? There's a lot of BS that comes with it. And that's where I tell, you know, most of my clients, they make over 150,000 a year. And once, you know, once you're above that pay scale, ultimately it comes down to what is your highest and best use or what is your hourly rate, and focus on optimizing or maximizing what is it your highest, your hourly rate. So somebody's a doctor, dentist, accountant, you know, product manager, computer programmer. Your time is better spent. Your highest hourly rate is not going to be screwing around with Airbnbs and fixing up little rental properties. But if you make under 100 grand a year at your day job, then that paradigm shifts, right? And I think that's what I talk a lot about in my new book, is like this idea of different paradigms, right? We talk about this concept of the wealth elevator. Instead of just throwing all these esoteric strategies at you, we break it down based on where your net worth is and what your annual income and expenses are at. And you start at the certain floor, whether it's the basement, floor one, floor two, the penthouse. And that's kind of where, you know, certain strategies become more prevalent in certain parts of the journey. But all that's free. Whatever you do, don't spend your money on some kind of nonsense training thing. It's all out there on the internet. You know, it's all on our website for free.
Yes, and your website is the simple cash flow. I'm sorry, let me see.
Simple passive cashflow.com. We are going to be rebranding it, however, in the future with the release of the new book, The Wealth Elevator. So if people just Google it, I'm sure they'll find it.
Yes, and I'll make sure that I'll link it in the description as well. I also want to ask you, what have been the rewards of succeeding?
Yeah, I mean, money has always been, in the essence, like it gets freedom, right? It allows you to do what you want, where you want. Like today, I mean, I still work 8 to 10 hours a day, but you know, on my schedule, I mean, just today, you were kind of my first appointment of the day. I went to the gym and I do CrossFit. We did a little hero workout, which took a long time. I came back, I had some coffee. I started my day at, what was this, 11 a.m. for late, right? Here at Hawaii. I'm a location independent. I can go wherever I want. Granted, I'm not some mega bummer because I got kids, right? But like, it's on my schedule, and sure, I'm gonna keep doing what I want to do, right? And you know, keep making money because that produces, you know, I think making money is a byproduct of creating value for society, or at least people who are willing to listen. You know, come to the website, read the book, right? But you know, I was living the grind just like everybody else, doing this job because you went to college to do it, and you know, your investments are, it's almost like it's an engineered system to keep you working in the damn thing forever. And I kind of try and stand up for that, the guy, that white collar professional who, quite honestly, is probably doing the most for society, whether they're drilling teeth as a dentist, a doctor saving lives in the emergency room, or like myself, that engineer stuck in the cubicle land, slaving away on the computer, doing something that nobody cares about, but is really beneficial to society, like a bridge or something. And this cohort are the guys who play the most taxes. It's totally jacked up, right?
Yes, I hate when people be like, they try to just come after the wealthy. And I'm like, first of all, if it wasn't for the wealthy, you wouldn't have a job, you know? So I'm like, and then the taxes are crazy.
I mean, well, I mean, not to get political or anything like that, but like, you got to distinguish the people, you know, the wealthy people, and like a lot of people in our community are first generation wealth, right? Like our parents didn't have $1 million to start off with, right? We had to kind of be good stewards of our own cash. Ultimately, our kids will probably be the most spoiled generation, is always right. And I think that's what I'm kind of pointing out. The wealthy, you could be the one that creates the wealth or the one that blows it, right? And typically, wealth leaves families in 2 to 3 generations. It's in, but there are, I guess what I'm trying to say is people with money, and let's just call it, a few million dollars and above. There's two types of people. There's people who understand how to invest in real estate and get the tax benefits to minimize their taxes to almost nothing. And there's the people who, the tax system, I do believe, is kind of created in a way to extract that value from people who are not creating value in society and just living off the previous generation's wealth. And those people will be taxed pretty effectively. But anyway. Yeah, I think the biggest thing is like it's all education, right? Not the stuff they teach you in school, but it's all it is pretty easy to make 10%, 12% plus returns on your money and then turn around and pay little to no taxes with a lot of these strategies. Why doesn't everybody do it, right? Well, everybody's stuck doing annuities or all these off-the-shelf traditional investments. That's what we're all brainwashed to do. I mean, and looking back at the next generation, the ones that are going to keep the wealth are the people who are educated. It doesn't matter if you strive to give your kids $1 million, $5 million. Who cares? If you give them 100 grand, but you instill the ways that the strategies that the wealthy use, then I think that's a lot more valuable than giving them $2 million head start.
Okay. Because I'm so thinking about all of that. It's a lot. I'm wondering, how can I set my kids up for success? Because I'm trying to plan all of that out before I have kids. And yeah, so I'm thinking about all of those things as well. Like, what would be the most effective way? So I'm glad you said
Yeah.
that.
I mean, the status quo would be like, all right, I'm going to work really hard, invest, and then create this big pile of cash and then give it to your kids. But if they're not good stewards of the money, they're just going to blow it, just like all these other trust fund kids out there.
Even if you have like rules set up on the trust fund.
You can't really create rules. It's their money. You'll be dead.
Well,
And it's a lesson learned that I've had, right? I'm an engineer. I'm sort of a control freak. You can't really write that thing with that all those protections in place. And ultimately, you have to play your part and teach them the values and the strategies, because
okay.
you can't really cr engineer a mousetrap for them to follow and stay within the constructs of and not blow their inheritance. Right. I mean, you think about it, right? Like, it makes too much sense. But then why does everybody have this goal of giving their kids $1 million, $2 million in inheritance? To me, it doesn't really make too much sense. In fact, the more you give them, again, going back to that law of diminishing returns, the more you give them, the more you set them up for failure, the more lazy they'll be.
Okay. I didn't think of it like that. Okay. 'Cause I was thinking, okay, this will help set them up for success. They'll be able to go straight into building some stuff, but okay, they might try to go straight into spending money instead of building stuff. Okay. So you have
But
multiple,
that'll probably be the next book, right? I'm all for, I think what it comes down to is teaching them, like, some people work for money, some people have money work for them. But again, I think this is a crucial part that everybody needs to go through is, if you're somebody who's making less than, saving less than 10, 20 grand a year, dude, I was there at one time. That's the grind portion. That's where you actually learn what the value of a dollar is. And you do things to get that starting principle. But then as you start to put into passive investments, it starts to grow and grow and grow on you. And then you appreciate it, what it was. If you're just kind of, launched up to the penthouse floor, number one, you don't know how to control it. And number two, you don't know what it was really worth.
You're right. You're right. So you have multiple successful businesses. I know the Huel Deal Pipeline Club has acquired over more than $300 million of real estate and raised $40 million. So can you tell us like about being an entrepreneur and how you were able to create so much wealth and have these successful businesses? Because I know a lot of times, you know, we can push out businesses and some are going to fail, but you have so many successful ones. Well, successful businesses.
It's just like growing your own personal net worth, right? Like you have to get yourself some level of something to start with. Mm-hmm. You can't make something out of nothing. And just like on the business side, you know, I can remember the first deals we did, like it was like such an uphill battle to raise maybe $1 million or $2 million to go buy an apartment. But, you know, today most of our clients are referred in from past clients, and you know, it just kind of just steamrolls, right? And that's, I think any business entrepreneur or business owner understands that whole concept, right? Like when you can get to a point where half of your leads are coming in from, you know, the people who you've made happy, or what we call it fulfillment, right, in the business, then you've gotten your point to a more mature business cycle. And then, you know, then you don't have to pay as much money in marketing. But that's essentially what it is, right? Like you have to kind of pay your dues in the beginning. It's kind of like compound interest, mm-hmm. but on a lot higher scale when you're talking about businesses.
Right. And what is the importance of building relationships when it comes to being an entrepreneur?
I mean, real estate is a team sport. It's a game built on relationships from, you know, individual investors and, you know, from vendors, right? Well, we use third-party property management companies. We've also fired a lot of third-party property management companies. But at the end of the day, the business that we're in, leasing little boxes to people to live in, is pretty simple business. And I think that's why maybe real estate, again, what it gets distilled down to is relationships, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I mean, I'm kind of a sports guy. Maybe it's similar to like basketball. The goal is to put the ball through the hoop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what separates the two teams at the end of the day? Some people will say, obviously, the stars, right? Your talent. But, you know, other than that, assuming everything else is the same, you know, I think for that, it's a lot of it is, you know, camaraderie and maybe relationships too.
Right. And I know this is probably going to be controversial a little bit, but it's a thing that people call nepotism, and then it's a thing where people call reverse nepotism. So they might say, okay, if you have parents that really burnt a lot of bridges and they know that that's your parents, you probably are kind of messed up with the relationships. But if you have parents that have done a lot of great things and built great relationships, then they can really benefit you in creating relationships so that you can also succeed. So I've heard people talk about that when talking about relationships as well. Or do you think differently?
Yeah, like nepotism is where, like if you're in a corporate community, like somebody who knows somebody gets a job, that's kind of as opposed to you who's maybe more qualified or somebody else. Is that kind of what that is? Sorry, yeah. I'm an engineer. I'm just a dumb real estate investor.
Yeah, something like that. You've built these relationships and you're in good with a certain group of people, so you're pushed through the door more. But say if you burnt a lot of bridges, which is the opposite, you could be even qualified, but because of you burnt a lot of bridges, you might be shunned away.
Yeah. I mean, I'll answer that question a little bit differently, if you don't mind. Like, okay, I mean, yeah. That's why it never lasted long in like corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, look at me. I'm almost 40, but I still look freaking like 23. Right. A lot of this has to do with like white hairs and how much, you know, but I don't think anybody is as quick and sharp as me in certain areas and as creative, and also combine that with working hard.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of self-belief in myself in that arena. And so to be in a corporate environment where you're in this, you know, almost like a union kind of based system, right? Where you, you work up through attrition and seniority, that really rubbed me the wrong way, right? And I think that's why obviously it kind of that pain point boiled up so much that it one of the things that propelled me to getting the hell out of that corporate America space. I can remember one time when I was at work. I was in management, in construction, and I remember like the director, he said like there was like me and then a couple interns, and I had been working at the company for like 8 years, and then he was like, "Hey, you interns, go and get this stuff, you know, like bring water, you know." I'm like, "Dude, I'm like a engineer, you know. I've been here at this company. I've been out there in the field managing crews, you know, like I don't know, just rubbed me the wrong way, you know." And some people can look at that and be like, you know, look at this guy, right? He doesn't know how to pay his dues. But like, I don't know. I guess I saw it as like, man, if I really want to move up in this company, because obviously I wasn't red circled, right? Red circle is, you know, what companies do when they identify their young talent so they can develop them and groom them for, you know, quicker movement into the management director, maybe AVP level, VP level, right? Obviously, I wasn't that. So for people who aren't on that fast track, I guess this is a kind of a negative attitude, I guess, calling myself out on it. But that's how it works, right? Because I was on the other side of it on the management side too. That's how it works, in large Fortune 500 companies. And I think that's why it's super smart for people, if you're not in that circle, will reinvent yourself and leave and go to a different company. Me personally, I just quietly did my job, bought rental properties on the side, and then around 2015 I had 11 of those things, and we started to buy large apartments in 2018, 19. That's where I pulled the plug and I was like, screw this, I'm gonna make way more money doing this other stuff. And I had the stability of my rental properties producing cash flow for me to have that, you know, that put food on the table, you know.
Right.
So yeah, I that whole nepotism thing, or like, you know, more of that seniority based promotion system, I really didn't like, you know. And that's why I think entrepreneurship really, it's not for most people. Most people don't have what it takes, and it is super risky.
Yeah.
But if I mean, maybe I just, I mean, I'll call it like I had something to prove, I'll be honest. And I think that's what still kind of propels me today. Like there's something to prove out there that, you know, that I wasn't just that kid who was just put into the system to slowly, you know, jump up to that manager director level if I slaved away for another 20, 30 years.
Right. And I get what you're saying about being in a position where somebody's telling you to get the water and stuff, and you're like, hold on, I can do this. And then sometimes you might even think, you're probably more qualified than their boss's boss. And why do you have me doing all of this? I think that's some
Well, I don't know. Like, yeah, I think I'm leaving something out of the story here too, right? Like around that time too, just like I had been buying rental properties for 4 or 5 years up to that point. I made more money than my boss and my boss's boss with all the, you know, the rentals at that point. So I kind of did, you know, I was a little cocky, I'll be honest. But
I feel you though.
you know, I mean, and you know, that's what I never liked about corporate America, right? Like, especially, you know, and not to say like age is a thing, but like if you're still in a manager role by the time you're in your 50s, you know, you're not there because you want to be, right? You're there because you have to be, because you need the paycheck every month. If you're really good at what you did, you probably would have been red circled at some point, or identified as a true leader that empowers others, that makes other people better around you. That, you know, you kind of just got promoted based on attrition. And that's what's frustrating, I think, for a lot of people that are in their 40s or even 45 or younger, is that you got to work for those guys. And that's a really tough person to work for because they don't have the leadership, courageous skills, and They're there because of money at the end of the day. Now, I'm not saying that that's everybody, but that's, typically what you find, I think, or at least what I found at the places I worked. Like the people who are higher level, director level, one above, like they have got great people skills, leadership skills, but it's that layer of that middle manager and maybe below that's like they're not there because they want to be. And if you're gonna work with them for the next 10, 15 years, that's a tough grind.
Yeah. So with entrepreneurship, you get all of that freedom. You don't really have to
Yeah.
worry about that. So I guess
But
with the
that said, like that's the reason why companies are so large, because it can take subpar talent and still produce a pretty dang good product at the end of the day. And looking, I would say for people who are looking to jump ship and start their own company, I would say consider working your way through a Fortune 500 company for, maybe at least 5 years and learn the ropes. I know that's something I talk about with a lot of people who have family businesses who are gonna, play the succession plan with their kids. It's a one of those big prerequisites where they're like, you can't come and work for the family. Because it's an kind of an embarrassment, like you're saying, nepotism, right? Putting somebody in it that doesn't deserve it. But a lot of times there's a prerequisite of, you have to get a higher level master's degree, or you have to be promoted twice through some other business. And I see that as one, go mess it up somebody else somewhere else on their dime, and then you can see how large companies do it. And so you can come back and bring back best practice, or at least empathy, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of times that I kind of pause and think, is like, well, from a leader perspective, was that really the best thing I should have done, talking to the person or strategically doing it this way? And I think back to a lot of the things I do in terms of leadership, and I think back to the first job when I, was a construction supervisor managing 30, 40, blue collar construction workers out in the field. That was where I cut my teeth, in terms of leadership style.
Because yes, the best leaders also know how to follow. So it is good to go and work for somebody else at some point so that you do know how to follow and see how other systems work.
Follow quietly, taking notes of things you're gonna do better, and then also hopefully buy rentals quietly on the side too. But
That's very smart.
thanks. Great question. Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you so much
Not
for.
often that I don't get asked the same old boring stuff again and again and again.
Well, thanks so much for being here. You're the first person who has over a billion in assets here. So it's an honor. I'm so happy you came. All right, thank you. Have a great
Thanks.
day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.